What a beautiful medley of songs about the love of the Lord and our love for Him. And we've been singing those songs all morning. And there are so many we don't have time to sing. One of my favorites is, love is the theme. Love is supreme. Sweeter it grows, glory bestows. Bright as the sun, ever it shows. Love is the theme, eternal theme. Before I get started, let me do a few thank yous real quick. Because I had a very, very active week this last week, and I owe so many so much. Thank you for all of your prayers for Dana as she had her foot surgery on Thursday. She has done amazingly, miraculously well, and some of you came alongside to help us out with some details in that, and I'm so grateful. Thank you to everybody who helped with various aspects of the concert Friday night. It was a great time together, and again, several of you all stepped up and took a direct hand in helping, and that was just, couldn't have done it without you. Thank you in advance to everybody who is helping out with putting together, bringing the food for our Thanksgiving season meal this evening. And if you're thinking about skipping that, don't, okay? It's a wonderful time of fellowship. And a great time just to be together. And man, these folks around here know how to cook. I'll just leave it at that. And it's always a special time. To me, the fall festival is not what really kicks off this season we're moving into. It's this meal. So hope to see everyone and bring somebody with you if you can. Well, continue on with the theme of love. Because the book that we're kind of paralleling here is C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves. We're going to 1 Corinthians 13, that amazing statement of love. A lot of people don't realize that it is a hymn. It is an early hymn that the Christians sang, and we don't know if Paul wrote the words and then it became a hymn, or if he's quoting something that his brothers and sisters were already singing, but it is given to us in this text. And one of the most soaring, unbelievable passages to me. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits nothing. What I've always loved about the way that's phrased is it starts to launch, it starts to take off, and then no. Without love, there's nothing. But then it goes on. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It is not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It's not provoked. It thinks no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And now it's taken off. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will fail. Where there are tongues, they will cease. Where there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For now we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abide faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Let's pray together. Love is the theme, Lord. Love is the center. As John tells us in his letter, God is love. It is the centermost aspect of your nature. It is who you are and what you want to pour into us. And yet we're confused about love. We get wrapped up in inferior sorts of love. We allow certain kinds of love to become our gods. And it is something that falls short of who you are. So help us to seek the high love, the agape love, the unconditional love in our lives. Empower us to love with the kind of love that we cannot love with in our own strength. Help us to show forth to the world who you are through your love. In Jesus' name, amen. In 1956, at the age of 58 years old, C.S. Lewis fell in love. Most of his life had been spent in an almost exclusive male society. His mother died, you remember, when he was 9 years old, and his father, very shortly after that, packed him off to an all-male boarding school. And he stayed that until it was time to go into a college preparatory thing for 2 years. That was all-male as well. He was accepted into Oxford, but also entered into the army in the same year when he was 18 years old. And of course, the army was an all-male institution, at least in terms of those who would fight. And so at 18 years old, he found himself on the Western Front in World War I at the Battle of the Somme, the second battle, where he was injured and then sent to a hospital for 6 months to recover. There were nurses there. They were untouchable, unknowable, especially for a young man who had never been around women much at all. Finally, he was demobilized and went back to Oxford at the age of 20. But his best friend in the service, a man named Paddy Moore, he and Paddy had made a covenant together that if one of them came back and the other one didn't, the one that came back would look after his family. It's actually kind of a lopsided deal because the only family Lewis had was his father, who was self-sustaining, and his brother, who was also in the military. But Paddy had a mother and a sister. And one of the first things Lewis did when he came back was take Paddy Moore's mother and sister into his household, and for that point on until Mrs. Moore's death in the 1950s, he took care of them. Took care of all their needs. And there was no room for a wife in a household like that. So at the age of 58, he believed that that opportunity had passed him by. He was awkward around women, especially intimidated by those he considered to be beautiful. He was tongue-tied around them. He considered himself to be damaged goods because he had a lot of problems and quirks that came from the difficulties of his upbringing. He didn't want to inflict himself on any woman he cared about. There's at least one recorded instance when he was so nervous around a female student once he became a tutor at Magdalen College, that he asked that she be reassigned to someone else because he couldn't think straight when she was in the room. Then there was the problem that so few people, male or female, could really engage the man intellectually. If you stop and think about the circle of friends he had, it was basically all the great names of English literature of the time. J.R.R. Tolkien, Charles Williams, Hugo Dyson, Dorothy Sayers, W.H. Auden, T.S. Eliot. That's rarefied atmosphere there. And then he met Joy Davidman. She was an American. And you know, the British have a thing about us. they pretty much, especially back in Lewis's day, they thought that we were crude and uncivilized and boorish. But besides that, it kind of got to their national pride that twice we bailed them out of wars that would have destroyed them. The same battle where Lewis was wounded, the Battle of the Somme, second go-around with that battle, was the turning point in the war. And what made it the turning point was the American military showed up and pushed the Germans back for the first time. The same thing happened again in World War II, and so a lot of the British, especially of Lewis's generation, had mixed feelings about Americans. But Joy Davidman was an American. Worse than that, she was a New Yorker. I speak as a New Yorker, so I can say that. New Yorkers are very brash and out front in their culture. Her parents were Jewish atheists. She herself was an ex-communist. She was a published poet and author and editor. She was the mother of two young boys, and she was the wife of a man who was an abusive alcoholic. She became a Christian through reading C.S. Lewis's books. And she wrote to him in 1950 expressing her appreciation for what he had written, and sent him a copy of a book she had just written called Smoke on the Mountain, a commentary on the Ten Commandments. It's a good book if you ever want to pick it up. They began to be correspondents. Lewis had many, many correspondents, male and female. We know of over 4,000 letters he wrote in his lifetime. But she came to visit a friend in London in 1952, and they met for the first time. And while she was in England, her husband wrote her saying he wanted a divorce. In 1953, Joy Davidman moved to England with her two sons to try to start a new life, and just to get away from all the pain of the failure of her marriage and the abuse that she'd suffered. In 1956, her work permit ran out and she was going to be deported from England, and she and Lewis had become friends by then. And so he married her in a civil ceremony just simply so she could stay in the country. It was just an on-paper thing. He did it as a friend. Maybe he couldn't admit that he had feelings for her too at that point. But later on that same year, she was diagnosed with bone cancer. She was only 41 years old. She fell and broke her leg. Later on, they found out that she broke her leg and fell because the cancer had eaten the bone away. And so in late 1956, she's in a hospital and she's been told that she's going to die. And Lewis realizes that he loves her and marries her for real on what he thinks is her deathbed. But God gives them a miracle, and she goes into remission, and ultimately they have 3 years together as husband and wife. And it was just as that remission happened that the Episcopal Church of America wrote to C.S. Lewis and said, "We want you to take any subject that you care to talk about, and we want you to put together a new series of broadcast talks like you did in World War II, but we want you to do them for American audiences to be broadcast here in America. You can be about anything you want, just tell us and we'll go with it." And Lewis was in love and newly married when he thought he never would be. And so he chose to write about love. Those talks became the book, just like the broadcast talks in World War II eventually became Mere Christianity. So the talks became the Four Loves. And Lewis, at the very beginning of the book, wants to make a distinction between two very different kinds of love. He says that there are two kinds of love, and they're as different as they are dogs are different from cats, or maybe that's not extreme enough. They're as different as ants are different from elephants. And the first kind of love is called gift love. Gift love is a love that gives without any need for receiving. It's love that simply gives because it can, and because it wants to, and because it chooses to. It's a love that comes from complete abundance. No need at all. And this is the love that comes from God. Have you ever stopped to think about the fact that God doesn't need us to love him? He is full. He is complete. We don't add to him in any way. So that's gift love. The love that only someone like God can truly have. And then there's need love. Need is love that comes from lack. Think about a newborn baby looking you in the eyes for the first time. And I don't know about you, but every time I have that experience of a very, very, very young child looking at me, there's trust there. There's love there. But that child needs us, or the child will die. That's need love. It's love that can never be unconditional because, by definition, conditions exist. It's a love that is ultimately dependent on another person. It's love that cannot be sustained on its own. Relationship counselors talk about, some of them, that we all have a love tank. And we can't just give and give and give and give and give and love and love and love and love without end, without getting anything back, because eventually the love tank empties out and there's nothing left. You've got to have love coming in order to have love to give out. That's need love. It's all human love. So Lewis says, you know, there's these two kinds of love. There's this gift love that only God really has, and then there's this need love. And yet the Bible calls us to love like God loves. And how can there be any common ground between these two radically different approaches to love? Jesus called us to be like him. How can we be like that? How can neediness ever be like fullness? Because at every moment we appear to be like him, we are in fact the most needy. The only reason we can be even a little bit like the Lord is because he's given to us the ability to do that. We can't do it on our own strength. We can't do it on our own. And Lewis gets around this in the book by telling a little parable about a person who's been hiking in the high mountains and he's coming back home. And as he comes home, he finds this cliff overhang that overhangs his village that he's traveling back to. And he can stand there, and just maybe 100 or 150 yards below him, there's home. He's close to home. But because he cannot scale that sheer cliff, he's got a long way to go. It's a long way around to actually get home. He says that there's moments when we can embody, we can feel that love of God, that unconditional love that's just so amazing. It can be pouring through us. We can embody it for a moment, but only for a moment. Just like we can see the village when we come to the overhang. But we still have a long journey to actually get there. We do know we'll get there, don't we? That's what the promise is. The village is down below, but we've got a long way to go to get there. Well, Lewis picks out four words that are in the New Testament, all of which translate out as love. One is storge. Another is philia. Another is eros. And another is agape. Now, he's very kind to us, and he doesn't make us stay in the Greek that way, but he gives us a translation. Affection, friendship, attraction, and charity. But, you know, really for you and for me, that word charity has changed since he was using it. Charity to us now means giving to something to someone who's in need and maybe they even don't deserve it. We have a different kind of use of the word charity. So I changed that to unconditional. So affection love, friendship love, attraction love, and unconditional love are the four. And these four don't exist separately and independently, but kind of, especially in human beings, mix around and get interconnected. In detail, that affection love is loving what is like us, loving what we resonate with, what we connect to. It's loving what is familiar. This afternoon, we'll have a great example of affection love, because we will come together because we're part of this spiritual community to share in a common meal in the season of Thanksgiving. We will be affectionate toward one another because we, for the most part, know each other and like each other and encourage each other. We are there for each other. But then there's one other thing that's also a part of affectionate love, because it's familiar. Food. Have you ever noticed that the word familiar has the word family in it? It's because they're related words. And we're going to have lots of familiar food tonight. Comfort food, we call it. That's what affectionate love is. It is comfort love. It's where we go. It's the person we go to when we need a hug. It's the person that we go to when we just need to feel that sense of family and community. It's a great love. Romans 12:10 refers to this kind of love, particularly when Paul says, "Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another." That kindly affectionate is that storge word. And then there's friendship, which is the opposite of phobia, by the way. Philia is the Greek word. Philia is one extreme. Phobia is at the other. Phobia is a fear or repulsion to something. Philia is an attraction because it comes from shared interest. And by the way, Lewis believed that this form of love was one of the highest forms of love. Friendship is a wonderful, wonderful gift to bestow on another person and to receive from another person. But he also says it's the least biological of the loves. It doesn't have that instinctual component to it. True friendship is something that you see something that you have in common, and that draws you together and brings you together. I've got an example of that in my own life, and that's the harp guitar community that I'm a part of. Back in 2002, but for the very first time, a group of 20 people who had played these strange instruments got together. And before that, they had never even known, some of them, that anybody else played those instruments, because they were so unknown back then. But that fellowship, that friendship has grown. And over the years, this last time that we were together, there were 45 of us together. And actually, the largest one was the year before, when there were nearly 70 of us from all over the world. And we were united in the love for this particular bizarre historical instrument. That's friendship. You always have something in common. And for you and your friends, it might be a football team or a baseball team or a particular hobby. It might be hunting. It might be fishing. But there's something that brings you together. It might be a love for a certain author or a certain set of movies or something like that. But that's friendship love. That's your chosen circle of people that you will love because you share an interest. And that kind of love comes out all over in the New Testament. 1 Peter 3:8 is a good example of it. "Finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Love as brothers." And that is the word philadelphos there, brotherly love. That's where Philadelphia comes from, the city of brotherly love. "Be tenderhearted and courteous, but love as brothers." Love is people who have something in common. We have something in common. We should all be friends because we have Jesus in common. Back during the days of the Radical Reformation, there were a group of people who said, the only thing we have in common is Jesus, and because of that, we're friends. And they called themselves the Society of Friends. We call them the Quakers. But we should all have that relationship. We should have that affectionate love. We should have that friendship love. Then it moves on to something that's a little bit more particular. The love of that comes from physical attraction. This is the most biological of loves. And some people put it down and say that it's something that will lead you away from God. But you know, God created physical attraction. There's a whole book in the Old Testament, the Song of Solomon, that celebrates aspects of that. And it's actually the most celebrated of all the loves in our culture. Think about all of the love songs, and they're almost always about two people seeing each other from across the room. Their eyes meet, and they're drawn to each other. You know that story over and over and over again through so many cultures, but especially in ours. But you know, this kind of love is also potentially the most destructive kind of love. It is a love of exclusion. It is a love that separates out two people. And it can be something that will tear you apart as much as it builds you up if it's not done right. I always think about that anti-love song by B.B. King, "The Thrill Is Gone." The thrill is gone away. Oh, I don't see you now, baby, but you'll be sorry someday. So many of this kind of love ends in disaster, ends in tragedy, ends in heartache and heartbreak. But if you've ever felt this kind of love, you know just how powerful it is. Actually, that is in the Bible, not just the Song of Solomon. It's really in the Old Testament that you find references to this in the Greek translation of the Hebrew. But one of the best ones to me is Esther 2:17, where it says, "The king loved Esther more than all his other women." She was part of a harem. "And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the others. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her the queen." And if you're not familiar with the story of Esther, go back and read it sometimes. It is an amazing story about how love can go wrong and God has to pull it back from the brink of disaster before it destroys his entire people. But then there's the last kind of love, unconditional love, never failing love. It's God's love as nearly as we can understand it. It's love without limits. It's love that is sacrificial, and it's the kind of love that we ought to be thinking about as we think about our veterans today. Because the love of country and the love of family and the love of all the other loves that our veterans have and hold and cherish expressed itself in a willingness to show sacrificial love. The willingness to lay down your life for another. That's ultimately where unconditional love takes you, because see, this love has no limits. This is not love because, or love if you do this, or any other kind of conditioning. This is love without condition. This is, I love you, period. Sometimes I love you in spite of. I heard a essay read out by its author this last week, as once again we have gone through another period where someone in their brokenness came into a crowd of people and opened fire and killed so many of them. One of the young men killed had survived the previous attack in Las Vegas. This senseless, pointless thing that seems to be almost a weekly occurrence. I'm so tired of taking that flag down to half-mast out there. Can we please get some sanity back in our world where we don't have to do it anymore? But one person was writing her thoughts out, an essay against hatred. And she said at the conclusion of it, "Here is my response to your hate. Here is my response to your violence. Here is my response to your death and your killing. I will love you. And there is nothing you can do about it. I will love you." Whoa. That's God's love. That's unconditional love. That's the love that 1 Corinthians 13 points to. It goes through all of those inferior kinds of love. When it gets to unconditional love and it just launches, that's where God's heart is, and that's who he wants us to be. But we've got to realize that love is dangerous. Love is powerful. It can pervade your life. It can transform your life. It can draw you day by day closer and closer and closer to who God created you to be. It can make you day by day more like Jesus than you've ever been before, but it can also kill you. It's like electricity. You know, electricity warms our spaces and lights our rooms and does so many things. But I've done a few funerals from folks who died from electrocution. It's a powerful, powerful thing. Lewis said, got to watch out for any of these inferior loves, these lesser loves from unconditional love becoming an idol and a god in its own right. And any of the others can. The affection love can be a god in its own right, where the family becomes so central and so powerful and so important. Those comforts become, they become a bubble that entraps you, a prison that you can't escape from. Friendship love can do the same thing. You can get bound to your friends, and your friends can actually take you to hell, quite literally. I've got to go to hell because that's where all my friends are. I don't think so. I don't think so. Physical attraction can destroy your life. We've already talked about that. All these things created by God for our good. But only unconditional love is truly pure. Only unconditional love can really power and bring into proper perspective all the other kinds of love. It's where our true need is to receive from him his gift love, as Lewis talked about at the beginning of his book. We need to receive it. We need to share it. We need to show it. And we need to return God's love to him as best we can. Whenever I think about the subject of love as it's talked about in the Bible, and I'm thinking about the challenge of us to truly love in a way that God would have us love, I always go to John 21. Do you remember that scene where Peter, who had denied Jesus three times, is given the opportunity three times to tell Jesus he loves him? But a lot of people don't realize, underneath the English, because it's obscured, this is the conversation that Jesus and Peter is having. Peter, do you agape me? Do you love me with unconditional love? And Peter responds, oh yes, Lord, I phileo you. You're my friend. I love you with brotherly love. Peter, do you love me? Do you love me with unconditional love? And Peter says, yes, Lord, I love you like my best friend. This is the actual conversation. Jesus is saying agape, and Peter responds, phileo. Third time, Jesus lowers the bar. Peter, do you even love me with brotherly love? Oh Lord, you know all things. You know everything. Peter gets upset. You know I love you like a brother. But all the time, Jesus was calling Peter to love him unconditionally. And that's what God is calling us to do, to love unconditionally, to love without limits, to love each other that way, to love the stranger on the outside that way, to love God himself that way, and we cannot do it in our own strength. But we can do it in his. That's the bottom line. We can do it in his. Is that your goal in your life? Do you lack God's love in your life? There is a way to receive it. And it's not rocket science. You just ask, and you shall receive. Let's pray together.